Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
This podcast contains explicit language.
So that happened. Happy New Year, everybody. On January 18th, The Huffington Post will be hosting a debate between the declared candidates for the chair of the Democratic National Committee. And the way things are shaping up, it's looking like the top contenders will be Minnesota Congressman Keith Ellison and Obama Labor Secretary Tom Perez. So, in advance of the debate, we'll continue to dig down into the distinctions between these two men and explain what's at stake for the Democratic Party. Meanwhile, incoming President Donald Trump has made a lot of promises about keeping the United States out of pointless military conflicts abroad. But in Yemen, which has become a destructive proxy war between Saudi Arabia and Iran, Trump is inheriting quite the quagmire. It's been almost a year since he's had anything substantive to say about Yemen, so I guess we're going to be trying to warn him that he'd better stop tweeting and start thinking about this. Finally, we're going to spend a little time on the legacy of outgoing President Barack Obama, with an eye this week on his judicial legacy, the appointments he's made, the opportunities he's lost, and the political precedents that have been left behind. As with most things in life, it's a mixed bag, only the contents of this mixed bag will shape policies affecting all of us for decades to come. I'm Jason Linkins, with Huffington Post reporters Akbar Ahmed, Jen Bendery, Zach Carter, and Arthur Delaney. And here's what happened first. Hello and happy new year to everyone out there. Welcome back to another year of the So That Happened podcast, your weekly dose of doom and false hope. My name is Jason Lincoln. I'm the editor of Eat the President of the Huffington Post. I'm joined, as always, by Zachary Carter.
Hey, happy new year, everybody.
Yes, and Arthur Delaney.
Happy new year.
And just before we get started, some business, a huge oversight on my part. The last podcast you heard, which was the one that happened before we became 2017, was the final podcast from our producer, Christine Canetta. She has gone on to take a job with SB Nation. We wish her the very best. She produced this podcast all year. Well, not all year, but like I think starting in February, and did a really fine job. We're also very happy to welcome our new producer, Amber Ferguson. Yay!
We're very excited about having Amber.
And we hope Amber will be here for at least a year. At that point, probably someone will offer her a better job and she'll leave. And, you know, I guess that's the Spinal Tap drummer of podcast jobs, except you don't die, you graduate. So that's great news. And we're stuck here talking about how weird and bad America is. But we're going to start today talking about the DNC race. The Huffington Post is going to be hosting a debate between the candidates for DNC chair. Zach, you recently interviewed one of those top candidates, Minnesota Representative Keith Ellison.
Yes.
And this is, we've talked before, this has kind of become an interesting and weird proxy fight between sort of outsider insurgents and the outgoing Obama administration. Having talked to Ellison, do you see any different kind of contours on this big debate?
Well, you know, so a month we talked to Keith Ellison this week, Democrat congressman from Minnesota, very prominent supporter of Bernie Sanders in the presidential primary. His main rival is Tom Perez, who we interviewed about a month earlier, who's the labor secretary for President Obama. He's still in office. Perez is, in a lot of ways, I think to many people on Capitol Hill, he's viewed as the most progressive cabinet member of the Obama administration. He's been very strong on both at the Department of Labor and in the Civil Rights Division of the Department of Justice. Ellison is viewed by most people on Capitol Hill as one of the strongest progressives in Congress. He runs the Congressional Progressive Caucus. There just isn't a whole lot of ideological daylight between these guys. The main difference is that it appears that President Obama has been supporting Tom Perez, while Bernie Sanders and much of the sort of Capitol Hill establishment is supporting Keith Ellison.
Yeah, Jason described this as insider versus outsider, but really it's everyone in Washington versus Obama administration.
Yeah, that's a better way of putting it. Yeah, Thanks for correcting me.
But you know, it wasn't clear that that was how it was going to work out.
This developed last month with Obama's press conference, basically.
Before Obama really jumped into this thing, essentially the entire establishment was deciding that they had decided that they wanted to make nice with the Bernie Sanders wing of the party. And one way that they could symbolically sort of salve the wounds from the primary was to put, you know, a Bernie person who everybody respects, who's Keith Ellison, in the DNC post.
Because the previous person who had the job was very controversially totally pro-Hillary.
And generally considered not good at her job. Debbie Wasserman Schultz is a Democrat from Florida. I mean, they lost.
Too bank friendly.
Petty lender friendly.
Really publicly bad.
Not a very good manager with the process. Made a lot of enemies. So this was something you could say to the Bernie people, all right, look, I personally think that it's a stretch to say that Debbie Wasserman Schultz cost Bernie the primary, but it is clear that they were not rooting for him to win at the DNC.
Right.
Not seen as a neutral arbiter. So giving the DNC post to Bernie people is a way to say, hey, we hear you, we care about you, you're important to the party. And Obama basically said no.
But he did it in characteristic Obama diplomatic fashion.
And by putting forward, you know, the most progressive guy that he's got essentially on his team. So in a sense, for the sort of left wing policy side of the Democratic Party, whichever one of these guys wins is a win for that for that circle. I think if you'd told most Bernie people a year ago that Tom Perez was going to be the next DNC chair, they would have been thrilled. But now that Keith Ellison is somebody who frankly is the front runner, still the front runner. He's got Chuck Schumer, Harry Reid, all of these centrist Dems, in addition to a bunch of the unions that backed Hillary. They're much more enthusiastic about seeing Ellison.
Now, these are both, like you said, liberal guys. People would be happy with either one. But you did, in your interview with Ellison, I think, draw out an actual disagreement between Perez and Ellison on how they would run the DNC.
Yeah, so a lot of what the DNC does is fundraising. It's responsible for just raising money that keeps the party going and makes it function. And there are different philosophies about the right way to raise money. Debbie Wasserman Schultz was sort of all money is created equal kind of manager. Obama had put in place a ban on donations from lobbyists. And during the Hillary Clinton campaign, Wasserman Schultz just sort of quietly lifted that ban and began receiving money from lobbyists again. In our interview, Keith Ellison said that he would reinstate that ban. There isn't, frankly, that much money that comes from lobbyists into the DNC. It's a pretty
small aren't these guys like aren't there bundlers who are get a bunch of money from their corporate clients and then fling it at the DNC?
True, but a lobbyist donation. Remember, we're talking about actual money coming out of their pockets going into the party, and it's only about 6 or 7% of the haul that the DNC brings in. And remember, lobbyists also work for the executives and the special interests who no one is saying that they, these donations will be broken up. But
unions have lobbyists.
Sure, sure.
Has Perez taken a position on this?
He has. Perez says that he wants to have everything on the table. So he rejected the idea of reinstating the ban.
Okay.
Aha!
So this is the difference. Look, the money to run the party, there people have legitimate differences about how you want to fund this thing. But I think Ellison's point that he made, I thought he made it pretty eloquently, was that it matters to the public the way you're perceived. And even if lobbyists, aren't the most crooked people in the world, right? The fact that they're working on legislation day to day, when they're giving to the party, it looks a little bit sleazy, and it sends a message by saying you're not going to take this kind of money about the type of party that you want to be. And it tells voters, Ellison has made a big deal about trying to focus on small dollar donations, much in the way that Bernie Sanders did,
sure,
in the famous $27 donation. It shows voters, hey, we really do care. And it's not clear, even Ellison's plan is, I think, he's hoping to get 33% of the party's money from small dollar donors. That's a lot more than zero, right? So it's a lot more than they're getting right now. But that's even that, it's not like the small donors are suddenly going to take over immediately. But it is a way of telegraphing to people, we want this to be a party that is Democratic, small D, not quite as focused on people who can write big checks.
Saying no lobbyists is like saying the Republicans in Congress saying we're ethical.
So
it's like not dismantling the ethics office.
Right, right. It's sort of like it's a small step, but it's symbolic. But
right. Even if that office didn't really do that much.
Right. But
you
right.
don't go around saying I'm not ethical.
Right.
So this week, Vox writer Matt Iglesias talked about the DNC race, and he said the simple logic of what the DNC should do is bring on Ellison as the chair and have Perez run as the governor of Maryland. That mm-hmm. that makes sense straight up and down, because you bring a more youthful element into the DNC by bringing in a Bernie supporter, and you put a strong progressive in a race against a popular Republican governor in a race that matters. So, I mean, it seems like outside of perhaps President Obama's perceptions of how the future of the DNC, it just literally seems like across the spectrum, we're talking from Vox to, I don't
right.
know, the Bernie Sanders coterie, there seems to be like an emergency consensus that Ellison's the guy. So what possible pitfalls are there from here to now? Obviously, there's the debate. Mm-hmm. And obviously, I think that
these guys like each other, though. They're not going to be flinging mud at each other.
Sure, of course.
This isn't like a bad thing. I mean, that there's a debate. This is great.
Mm-hmm. I feel there are, of course, going to be probably liberals out there who have more purer things in mind than I do. But to my mind, the DNC race is an embarrassment of riches for liberals right now.
It seems pretty good. I think one thing to remember, though, is that the general public doesn't elect the DNC chair.
Right. Yeah, that's true.
It's 447 people. It's sort of the super delegate team that ends up doing this. It's state and local party officials, most of whom got behind Hillary Clinton last year. So Ellison's got to make, you know, he's got to close the sale with those people, and a lot of them don't want to vote for him just because he's a Bernie guy. A lot of them are perfectly willing to vote for him just because he's a Bernie guy. It really is a matter of who's going to be able to work the phones best with those 447 people to rack up a majority. But so far, frankly, both he and Perez have you know made good public presentations about themselves. Perez has got to do a lot of work to make up the ground that he's already lost in endorsements. You know, Ellison's been endorsed by the AFL-CIO.
He got a late start, Perez.
Yeah, he jumped into the race late. It's not impossible for him to win, but it does seem like Ellison's got a head of steam behind him.
I know this is mostly a fundraising job, but I'm interested to hearing from both these guys about how they will also increase competition at local and state levels for Democrats, because it's been woeful. All right. Big debate. When is the debate?
Debate is January 18th.
And we'll be live streaming that on our site.
Mm-hmm. You will be able to access it at thehuffingtonpost.com. We're hosting it at George Washington University here in Washington, D.C. And it should be I think it'll be a fun, substantive, informed discussion.
All right. Please tune in for that. Zach and Arthur, thank you for talking about this. And we will be right back.
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weight loss. That's PlushCare.com/weight loss. PlushCare.com/weight loss.
And we're back. Guys, I'm here with Arthur Delaney.
Hello.
And we're joined by our foreign policy reporter, Akbar Ahmed.
Hi.
And we want to talk about the conflict in Yemen, which the United States is inextricably tied to right now.
Yes.
And we're about to hand this off to Donald Trump. I think we've talked a little bit about before the state of play and what Donald Trump is inheriting. But Akbar, I know you have some new things to talk about in terms of the Yemen conflict. So what's going on right now? How did things change since we last time talked? Since the last we talked about this,
things are getting worse.
Oh, great!
Unfortunately,
as
Trump takes
Happy
office,
New Year.
Civilian casualties have spiked over the last couple of months. There was a failed peace process that went nowhere because the side the U.S. is supporting, the Saudi side, has sort of made it impossible to move forward. They're not willing to have a real negotiation to end the conflict. Everyone says, John Kerry, who heroically leads diplomatic efforts all the time, sometimes they work, keeps saying it's going to be a political process, not military. But right now, civilians keep getting killed, so it looks a lot more military, and that keeps happening with U.S. weaponry, U.S. fuel, U.S. intelligence.
So are the Saudis waiting to see what their backers, the U.S., does with the transition of power? Is that the reason for things getting worse?
I think the reason is more they are just getting more and more stubborn. It's becoming a PR factor for them, right? They need to show that they have won, and so they can't accept any kind of ceasefire or negotiation that makes them look bad. But they're definitely waiting and are really hopeful about Trump. Many in the Gulf see Trump as one of their own. They see him as a businessman, someone who will take Saudi money, Gulf money, deals, investment. Trump's only comments on Yemen were about a year ago, January 16th of 2016, when he said, I don't mind supporting the Saudis, I'd be happy to, but they have to make sure it economically benefits us. So this is kind of presenting the U.S. as a mercenary force, which suggests he's not going to back out of the war. He just wants to receive more money for helping the Saudis there.
Isn't that contrary to his usual position that we needlessly entangle ourselves by bombing or helping people bomb things in other countries?
And this is the conundrum for him. I mean, he wants to try to pull out of Middle East conflicts. He says he's against Iraq, against Afghanistan, you know, hates Hillary Clinton for regime change. But here he says, if we can make a buck off it, we'll keep doing it. The story I'm sort of working on is about how the Saudis are trying to court him with this idea of deals of, you know, there's a great piece called Sheikh Donald of the House of Trump, right? They'd like to see him as that kind of player. I think they will be sorely disappointed.
What leads you to believe they'll be disappointed?
I think that the ideological aspect of his White House seems to be solidifying. This is something we saw last month with the Berlin attacks. So while there is an aspect of him that's this deal-making, business type, there are a lot of people whispering in his ear who are like, why do we need a Muslim partner? Whether that's Saudi Arabia, whether that's Iran or Turkey, we hate them all equally. So it'll be interesting to see who wins out.
Who is an example of a Trump whisperer who holds that position?
Steve Bannon, who's going to be, you know, very high up in the White House. Breitbart is obsessed with Saudi atrocities. It's obsessed with the idea of, here is what Muslims do with U.S. support, so just abandon a Muslim world, right, and walk away from them. I don't think he'll cut off support immediately, but he could if he wanted to. The U.S. has three main channels of support, and Obama has chosen not to cut off despite more than 10,000 civilian casualties, the vast majority by the Saudis and the U.S. Trump could, the second he comes into office, say, I'm not going to give you refueling and I'm not going to give you intelligence. That would really be in keeping with his campaign promise of, you know, pulling back from Middle East.
He's not going to let them use our planes to refuel their planes while they carry out bombings on civilians.
Right. He could do it. And it sort of highlights the hypocrisy of that position he had on the campaign trail, because it looks very unlikely that he'll shut it down right away.
What is current U.S. policy on what should happen in Yemen? How do they want to resolve this? If the conflict would be resolved in any possible way, where would they like it to be?
It would be at the United Nations. There would be a new UN Security Council resolution on Yemen. The trouble is that the U.S. is trying to both present itself as a neutral broker in these negotiations while supporting one side.
Right.
So you can't do that. And that's what everyone else in the conflict says. Now some people are looking to Putin's Russia, suggesting they would play a role in negotiations. Iran is fairly involved in Yemen as well. They're supporting the militia the Saudis dislike. It's unclear whether it'll happen.
So imagine we did withdraw support for the Saudi effort. What would happen, do you think?
So it would fall apart. That's the really interesting part of this, is the Saudis are really playing with fire by relying so heavily on the U.S. Because the second that gets pulled back, their bombing runs, their capacity diminishes like tenfold, if not more. Their bombing runs go from something like 4 hours to 15 minutes. Their ability to strike multiple times a day is severely reduced because they don't have the intelligence coming from U.S. sources. So they would be severely limited, and it would make them look horrible this conflict already makes them look terrible, right?
Right.
They're starving Yemeni children. They're doing a blockade. No one in Yemen has medicine. Doctors Without Borders has had to leave part of Yemen because the Saudis have bombed them so many times.
So would the government in exile there be able to return to power and restore order in absence of these bombings?
No, because it's the Saudi-backed government. So it would just be they would continue to be out of power.
I'm sorry, I had that backwards.
Right, and the alternative government that's been set up, the Iran sort of linked government, would gain increasing power, which, as we know, mentions of Iran drive congressional Republicans nuts. So that
the conundrum here is that if you pull out and stop supporting the Saudis, you de facto strengthen the position of the Iranians in this conflict.
So two of Trump's, you know, big positions, and we see this collide in Syria too, where he says he wants to be tough on Iran, but he wants to help Bashar Assad. He doesn't seem to know how he's going to deal with these things. However, there's a strong moral case to be made, humanitarian groups are making, for just pulling the support and figuring it all out later, right? Allowing the U.S. to actually become a neutral broker and say, okay, now negotiate. And by the way, Saudi Arabia, we don't want to be associated with your war crimes.
So we're left to guess whether we should expect Trump to be Trumpy and follow through on positions he's taken with regard to foreign policy or the Saudis, or will people in Trump's inner circle have their way, and there's basically no way to predict what the U.S. government will do. It's a total crapshoot.
It is for the Saudis, too. They're hoping that people like General Mattis, who he's picked for the Pentagon, are going to push him in a very anti-Iran direction, so he'll stick with the Saudis. But he hasn't said, and his relationship with the Saudis is interesting. He's a 9/11 truther, if you recall. And he just believes a lot of things. And he's also, you know, pointed to them as U.S. partners who he would reassess the relationship with.
Now, on top of all this, there's been recent polling data that even though we've been taking the Saudi side, there's been recent polling data that suggests that United States-Saudi relationships are as frail as they've ever been.
Yeah, Americans don't like Saudi Arabia. Maybe if they let women drive, more people would like them, right? And that's sort of what people keep advising them to do.
Let women drive.
Yeah, absolutely.
Everything's cool.
It'd be a little better.
I'm not sure.
It would, though, right? It would be a little better.
It would be significantly better, actually.
I think it would be cosmetically better.
True.
You're still dealing with a regime that is, you know, endlessly corrupt and
horrible towards women. And
plays too big a role in this region in the first place. What's to be done for the Yemeni people at this point in time?
Well, the scary thing...
What would the Yemeni people even want out of this?
I think
Want the return of the government? Do they want this militia to take over?
I think a lot of people just want stability, right? They want the war to end. You can't even buy food in Yemen now because food importers won't go there, both because of there's a Saudi naval blockade and because no one in Yemen has the money to buy food. It's just not, you know, worth it.
Even if we pull our support, that Saudi naval blockade stays in place.
It depends. The Saudis could have to majorly reassess their position and say, okay, now we need to do a strategic, just pull out. Right? And it's a lot of people have compared this to Saudi Vietnam. It really makes them look awful. And it doesn't help the U.S., which is trying to say in Syria, you know, Russia is helping commit war crimes. Yemen, the U.S. is doing the same thing.
I mean, it sounds to me like the only thing that's keeping us from doing the right thing here is the perception that we will be aiding Iran.
Right. But it really depends on how Trump and the congressional GOP's relationship goes, because they could pressure him and say, look, this is an Iranian expansionist plot. Unclear how receptive he is to that, but they will certainly push back on any effort he makes to do what might be the right thing.
Okay. All right. Well, man.
Handing off our proxy wars, part of the peaceful transition of power.
Yeah, so peaceful. All right, Akbar, thanks for joining us today. And Arthur, we will be right back. And we are back, and we're going to now talk a little bit about the outgoing president, Barack Obama, and his legacy. Joining us, we have Zach Carter.
Hi, everybody.
And we are very pleased to have our good friend and compatriot, Jen Bendery.
Hello.
So, Jen, we were going to talk about Obama's judicial legacy. And right off the bat, obviously his judicial legacy has been somewhat marred by the fact that Merrick Garland never happened.
Yes, that so that was that's probably the thing that makes the most headlines about Obama's judicial legacy, that, you know, Republicans denied him a Supreme Court pick for almost a year.
Breaking
and now Donald Trump gets to fill
quite
that
a number
seat.
Of norms.
Yeah, so that was pretty unprecedented. But I think it's worth taking a step back and looking at the last 8 years and collectively seeing what his legacy will be. And it's actually it's pretty impressive. He has put more people of color on federal courts than anybody before him. He's put more women on courts, more LGBT judges, more Asian American, more African American. I mean, just pick a group of people that are not straight white men.
Represented at all.
Straight white men.
Yeah.
And he filled out federal circuit courts and district courts all over the country with the most diversity this country's ever had. So that is a huge difference between him and past presidents. In total, he got something like 329 federal judges confirmed. And for some contrast, George Bush got 327. Bill Clinton got like 380. So, you know, just ballpark numbers, he's in there roughly where everybody else is.
Despite the fact that he was often obstructed.
So that was the good news for him. The bad news is that there's a broader context. He is leaving office with more vacancies than past presidents. So, for example, while he confirmed or appointed 329 federal judges and Bush appointed like 327, they sound the same. When Bush left office, there were something like 56 vacancies across the country on federal courts. When Obama leaves, there's something like 85 or 90. So,
and these are all seats that can be filled by whoever Donald Trump wants.
Yes, and I should clarify, it's actually more than 100 vacancies on district and circuit courts nationwide. That is almost double his predecessor.
Yeah.
And these all are being passed over to Donald Trump to fill. And this was an intentional move by Republicans in the Senate who fought tooth and nail for years to prevent Obama from filling any possible lifetime court seat that they could, because they were hoping a Republican would win this year, and he did, so that that Republican president could pick different nominees and fill out all those court seats with Republican preferred nominees. So it worked. This was all the plotting of Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell, and it worked. So it's not just Merrick Garland who got denied a Supreme Court seat, but it's literally dozens of district and federal courts that did not get judges put on them because Republicans held the seats open for Trump.
This is one of the least understood elements of the obstruction strategy, because if you look at legislatively, Obama got a lot of the things that he wanted. Right, he got the Affordable Care Act. He got Dodd-Frank. You know, he repealed most of the Bush tax cuts on the wealthy. There's a lot of things that clearly Obama wanted to see happen that did happen in his presidency, despite the obstruction, and he was reelected. So the narrative until Donald Trump won was, well, this obstruction strategy doesn't seem to be paying off for Republicans. But these are lifetime appointments, so a lot of policymaking happens on the bench, and not just the Supreme Court. And so Republicans are going to be able to do a lot of, you know, anytime someone's challenging an abortion restriction or same-sex marriage or whatever we have, they're going to have judges that are going to be friendly to them for a long time.
Well, and it's a mixed bag right now, because even though there is now this potential for Trump to fill out a huge number of court seats, more than anybody before him as president, he hasn't done it yet. The Senate has work to do if they're going to get this done. And for the time being, Obama just put a whole bunch of judges all over federal courts, which for the time being is going to have a huge effect on major legal decisions. And that includes, I know a lot of statistics because I cover this stuff so much, so, you know, I'm not an encyclopedia on everything, but I do know that there are 13 appellate courts across the country, federal circuit courts. When Obama took office, only one of them was predominantly Democratic appointees on it, and now there's 9.
Yeah.
That's a huge difference.
It's a big swing. Yeah.
And, of course, on the Supreme Court, Obama put on 2 Supreme Court nominees, 2 relatively young women, 1 woman of color. So that's a huge shift in the way that court works. And the second most powerful court is the D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals. Just beneath the Supreme Court, but extremely powerful. It controls a lot of rulings that affect things like Obamacare, for example, or executive orders. Obama appointed 4 judges to that court in the last 8 years, and he tilted the leaning of that court to a 7-4 Democrat to Republican appointee balance. So that those things are going to have an effect. Even though Trump is well positioned to fill out all these other empty seats, he hasn't done it yet. And for the time being, there's a huge effect right now that Obama is having on court decisions at the federal level and across the whole country.
What happens in the escalation of the parliamentary arms race in Congress? I mean, one of the reasons that it was perhaps appalling to see people like Mitch McConnell block so many of Obama's judicial appointments is that he didn't actually enjoy a supermajority in the Senate, and even a majority until recently. And now the Democrats find themselves out of power, but not so far out of power they can't bung up the works. What's to stop the Democrats from, doing the same thing to Trump as they did to Obama?
Well,
I'm not saying that's a good thing. At some point, I do think that people need to, come off the ledge on this brinksmanship, because it's going to get toxic and terrible before it gets better if we don't. But what are Democrats thinking about? How did they approach Donald Trump? Is it tit for tat? Is it give as good as you get?
Well, it's a bit different now because in 2013, as you know, Democrats unilaterally got rid of the filibuster rule for nearly all judges.
Right.
So what that means is it only takes 51 votes in the Senate to confirm any judge except for a Supreme Court nominee. That means any circuit court judge, any district court judge. And it used to take 60 votes. Now it takes 51. That was a huge shift
in
the Senate. So now here we are, and they did that because Republicans were blocking every single nominee all the time on every procedural step possible. And it was just untenable. So it was an untenable situation, and it was personally, I don't blame Democrats for blowing up that rule. But now, you're right, they're in the minority. Republicans can now push through judges at 51 votes every single time.
Right, it's a little bit, except, be careful what you wish for.
And I think Democrats knew that going into this, and they were willing to take that gamble because it was so bad that nothing was happening before. No judges were getting confirmed. And remember, it's not just a game of politics. There's courts out there trying to work.
Right.
They don't care about if you're a Republican or Democrat.
They
have people waiting to get their cases heard. Regular people, everyday people, who, if I got discriminated against at work, I would, if I wanted to sue my boss, that case would get delayed potentially years now because there's not enough judges on that court to take cases. So now, Democrats are in the minority. They're going to have to figure out how are they going to try to stop these judicial nominees from coming through if they don't like them. But it's the key here is that it takes 51 votes to confirm a judge out of, 100 people in the Senate. The split in there right now is 52 to 48.
Right.
Is extremely close, which means Republicans can only afford to lose two, right?
Yeah. Anytime.
Anytime. And it's not like everyone is the same. All Republicans vote the same and all Democrats vote the same. You'll have plenty of cases where there's always an occasional moderate, like Susan Collins from Maine is a pretty moderate Republican. Or you might have Rand Paul, who's just like a who knows what. He's just a loose cannon and unpredictable. He might not like a certain nominee. There's bad blood with certain nominees and certain senators for other reasons,
right?
Because they know each other sometimes. So
sometimes they've run against each other for
public
office.
I mean, it's a small enough world where there's judges and lawyers in states who know each other, right? So I don't think it's going to be a cakewalk for Donald Trump to fill out courts. I think he's got it easier than Obama because of this rule change and Republicans having the majority. But have some work to do.
Have Democrats talked about doing to Trump what Republicans did to Obama in terms of the Supreme Court?
Well, the only thing we've heard so far on that is Chuck Schumer, who's the new majority leader. He made a comment a couple of days ago that got a lot of attention where he said, we're going to keep that seat open. And if you look closer at what he said, he's saying we're not going to let any nominee get through if they're not mainstream. Okay, so that's a little hedging, which is important to note. But Democrats do have some real control this time. It takes 60 votes to confirm, to advance a Supreme Court nominee. They have 52 Republicans. They can't pick someone who's completely fringe, ultra-conservative out there that the Heritage Foundation would love necessarily. They need eight more people in the Senate to like this person. So I don't think Democrats can or would keep the seat open for that long, but they're not going to – they can absolutely prevent an ultra-conservative pick from getting through.
Interesting. All right. Well, I imagine you'll have more to talk about this on the site.
A little bit.
All right. So keep an eye out for Jen Bendry next couple of weeks is we all here at the Huffington Post submit our briefs on Obama's legacy in the wake of the new inauguration coming up. So Jen, thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
And we'll be right back.
So that's what happened this week. This podcast was produced, edited, and engineered by Amber Ferguson. Our executive producer is Nick Offenberg. I'm Jason Linkins. This week, we were joined by Akbar Ahmed, Jen Bendery, Zach Carter, and Arthur Delaney, Huffington Post reporters all. So That Happened is available on iTunes at itunes.com/sothathappened. Check out the whole family of Huffington Post podcasts in the iTunes store. And while you're there, subscribe and tell your friends. If there's something you'd like to hear us talk about, please send us an email at sothathappened@huffingtonpost.com. Thanks to all of you for listening, and welcome to a new year.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.